Well, I can write.
Yeah, I can.
I think
that.
My nickname's gonna be Remuneración.
That's good. Oh, I thought we could also be like our fave character. We could do our fave character.
Okay, then
I'm
Boyer.
You're Boyer. I'd be Costard, obviously. Oh,
fuck off.
You were gonna choose Costard?
Well, those are both my. Those, you each picked two of the best characters.
You don't
so.
Like Barone? He's all over the fucking place.
I'll take Don Pardo, whatever the fuck his name is.
Don Pardo.
And you can take musical guest Kenneth Brodo.
And you can take Don Amato. Got there. And you can take Boye.
Special guest star Nathan Lane.
Will you let me know why? I'd rather Charleston. Charleston? That's the sort of thing I would never do. So leave it behind me. Charleston.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Why Did We Watch This, the podcast where three friends sit down, have a nice drink, watch a not-so-nice movie, talk about what was good, what was bad, and how we could all do it better. I am your host for this week, Lee, the Don Arbor, Don Carbonara, the Don Delahanty.
I'm Chris Remuneración. Ravel.
And I am Brendan. I get no kick from cocaine. Drischler. I don't. Look at this amount of cocaine, guys. I'm just going to blow it into your faces. I got no kick from it. Now let's go on a biplane. Who wants to come with?
Me.
Make sure you're buckled in.
Yep, I'm going to do some loops. Yeah.
If you could not tell from those nicknames, we have just finished watching...
And how could you not? Because it was all true to the text.
It was all true to the bard. 2000's Love's Labor's Lost. Not written, but...
Well, I mean, it adapted.
Adapted by Kenneth Branagh, directed and starring Kenneth Branagh, along with just a cavalcade of stars.
Yep. Nathan Lane, Adrian Lester, Matthew Lillard, Natasha McElhone, Alessandra Nivola, Alicia Silverstone, Timothy Spall. I think those are...
Well, like Emily Mortimer?
Yeah, like this is a weirdly
small... She doesn't get many lines,
small...
but she's there.
I read this the last time we did the mini, and you were like, you forgot about...
Yeah, Nivola, Alessandra Nivola, Alicia Silverstone, Natasha McElhone, Kenneth Branagh, Carmen Ejogo. I don't know how to say her name. I'm sorry, Carmen.
I think you did okay.
Serafina Pickery from the Fantastic Beasts franchise that we all know and love. We all remember and love Serafina Pickery, mm-hmm. our fave character. From the Fantastic Beast franchises. She is the president of magic.
Sorry, she's the president of Makusa.
That's right, Makusa.
What was that magical...
Was the silliest name.
Magical Congress of the United States of America. Makusa
great
is
name.
Very bad.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, great choices.
Makusa.
I really didn't...
Just a really, really a great indication of the other great choices J.K. Rowling would choose to make.
Both within and without.
Yeah, all throughout her life.
Anyway.
So, we watched that movie. Obviously, we had to have a drink to get through it. What did we drink?
The drink we made was, I get no kick from champagne, which is sparkling white wine and honey peach simple syrup. The honey peach simple syrup is some pretty straightforward stuff. Obviously, it was basically just one part water, one half part honey, one half part sugar. And then I threw in some cut up and washed peaches. And I also threw in a little bit of a citric acid. Why not? To see if it would make it sour. I don't think it did, but it's there anyway. And you just let it, you know, sort of boil and simmer for a while and then strain everything out, put it in a lovely little bottle, and that's your honey peach simple syrup. But for the drink itself, you pour two parts chilled sparkling white wine and one part honey peach simple syrup in a champagne flute. Give it a little gentle mix if it has not mixed itself, and serve. That's it.
Couldn't be simpler.
Very simple, very powerful.
Leave me mix thyself.
It was very yummy. It was light. It was almost brunchy, both in appearance and I think in flavor.
Yeah.
It was very honey forward, which I enjoyed. I liked
it. Yeah, it was. It was more honey forward than I thought it would be, actually, but I'm glad of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It adds a little something to
nice
it.
Nice drink.
Yeah.
I get Bellini's fairly often. There's a restaurant I go to with my parents. It's like the one restaurant they go to these days.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a nice restaurant, to be fair, at least. And they have a... The Bellini is like the one thing there I will drink because it's hard for them to fuck it up in that suburban way.
Do you get a kick from it?
I do get a kick from it.
Great.
Thank you very
and
much.
And then you and your parents blow rails right there.
Yeah,
at the table.
That's right.
Yep.
Of cocaine.
Yep.
Fly off in your biplane.
Two lines of cocaine.
Your dad falls out. You give him a gentle kick. He hits the moon.
Yep.
All that great stuff.
Yeah.
So before we talk about this movie in earnest, I suppose we should learn what happens in it.
Right.
What happened?
So obviously it's based off a Shakespeare play. So if you know at all... The Shakespeare play, Love's Labour's Lost, which you probably don't, you'll have a good idea of what's going on. But anyway, just to go into the specifics of this, The King of Navarre has vowed to avoid romantic entanglements, to spend 3 years in study and contemplation. His chief courtiers agree to follow him in this vow, though one, Barone, argues that they will not be able to fulfill this plan. Barone's claim is proven correct almost instantly. The Princess of France comes to Navarre to discuss the status of the province of Aquitaine. Though the king does not grant them access to his palace, they are forced to camp outside. Each of the courtiers falls in love with one of the handmaidens, and the king falls in love with the princess herself. The men attempt to hide their own loves and expose those of their fellows. After a masked ball in which the pairs of lovers are comically mismatched, all the amours are revealed. Costard leads a musical number with the king's court, which eventually includes the entire cast. But as the song closes, a messenger arrives with news of the King of France's death. As the year of mourning that will proceed for the princesses and her ladies mean further courtship is impossible, and the women had up until this point treated the men's courtship as nothing but a mocking merriment to entertain their guests, they request demonstrations of humility and constance from the men, with a promise to marry them at the end of the 12 months if they carry out these acts. Newsreel footage shows the characters' lives over the course of that year, which take place in the context of World War II. The montage ends with all those who survived the war, boy, we specifically see die in some covert military action.
What a call out.
Yes. A character who they have not mentioned previously in the synopsis, being like, but he's dead. Rewriting in a celebration on what appears to be VE Day, the comic underplot of the original play in which Costard and the others attempt to stage a play, rather like that of the Rude Mechanicals in A Midsummer Night's Dream, is severely curtailed, as is the boasting of the Spaniard Don Armado.
There you go.
That's the end.
Can we just say, we got in a little covert kill your coded gaze there.
Yeah, we did. We truly did.
The only character that doesn't make out of this game.
Right. Although, I think Custard's overcompensating for something, you know? I'm just saying it was a bad time to be gay. Maybe he has to be, you know, a little too aggressive with the handmaidens.
You know, and Boye was arguably doing one of the gayest parts of...
talking to women?
No, of fighting in World War II, which was the
being
French Resistance. Was there anything more gay?
Is there anything gayer than the French Resistance?
I think not.
Yeah. There's a little beret on.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Real quick, I'll just give a breakdown of the cast because I feel like we might not remember names or even actors' names, but here we are.
I'll probably just refer to them by actors.
Yeah.
Alessandra
Nivola as the Alessandra Nivola as the King of Navarre. Alicia Silverstone is the Princess of France. Natasha McElhone is Rosaline. Kenneth Branagh is Barone. Carmen Ejogo is Maria. Matthew Lillard is Longueville. Adrian Lester as Dumaine. Emily Mortimer as Catherine. Richard Briers is Nathaniel. Geraldine McEwen as Holofernia, a female version of the male Holofernes in the original play.
My apologies. That was a long time coming.
Stephanie Rocca as Jack Winnetta. Nathan Lane as Coster. Timothy Spall as Don Armado. And then you've got like Moth and Dahl, who like don't really matter that much.
Dahl has the great line where he just goes, "I am Dahl."
Yes.
Indeed. That should have been my nickname.
That should have been.
I am Dahl.
We'll go do a second take of that.
Drop it in.
He says it just like that.
I am Dahl.
So that is Love's Labour's Lost.
It is. It's a Shakespeare play.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's talk about it. So this is Branagh's bread and butter.
Yep.
Or at least at this stage of his career.
His brawn and butter.
His brawn and butter.
Would we say the most successful it's ever been was Much Ado? Probably.
I mean, people like Hamlet. I've never seen Hamlet because I don't really care, but Hamlet is like the entire play. It is like 4 hours long because it is the entire play. And I feel like people liked that. I never saw it because I don't care.
I liked it.
But
it's good.
Yeah, I'm sure he did a very fine job with Hamlet. I'm sure it's a very handsome and well-acted production.
Have you seen the Ethan Hawke modern-day Hamlet?
I love Ethan Hawke modern-day Hamlet.
Hamlet 2000.
Yeah, Hamlet 2000.
Don't
goofy
you love
ass
when
book.
He wrecks all the videos at
yep.
Blockbuster?
Yeah. And how like the play is like a film studio project that he assembles
so
himself.
Yes, I'm doing mwah, Italian
mwah. Beautiful. There fucking love it. How one of the characters was replaced by a fax machine.
Which
one? It's like a messenger, and the fax machine has the name of the messenger written on it.
That's funny. That's really funny.
So great. Fucking love it.
It's sort of been his shtick for several years by this point to do Shakespeare's,
right,
where he directs it and also is the main character.
Right. He's also, there are times, because I'm pretty sure, I could be mistaken having not seen, but Hamlet is not period accurate, right? Isn't Hamlet more like 1800s in his version than it
probably
would have been?
I mean,
because I'm pretty sure I've seen pictures of the costumes and cast, and they do not look
also done like, I don't know when it falls in the timeline, mm-hmm, but he has a version of Twelfth Night that's like a theater production,
right,
that's like filmed,
mm-hmm,
that you can watch professionally,
right, right,
and that one is also very much Victorian.
Yes. Much Ado, I don't know well, but that's not a period appropriate setting either, I think, right? Like, I'm pretty sure that's a little later.
That is, I don't know if it's quite Regency.
Okay.
But it's the settings updated to the 19th century.
Okay, great. 19th. So yeah, 1800. So I feel like that's also been a little bit of his thing too, where like he is being faithful to the text, but he is updating it and transplanting it as, you know, as it interests him, I would say.
And it's sort of like a style experiment, right? Because it's like, we keep the text the same, but we're maybe changing how it's presented. We're changing how things look, sound, feel.
I mean, that's not unusual.
I was going to say, I don't know when we first started doing this sort of like, let's update it, but keep the text as the same, but everyone's going to wear modern costumes and shit.
Yeah.
I don't know when that started happening, but like, that's definitely a thing. Yeah. And I mean, I know, and like, that's fine. I have no beefs with that as a concept, obviously, because like, look, these plays are hundreds of years old. You have to do different things to keep them fresh and interesting, and obviously directors with vision should be allowed to interpret things as they wish, you know, just sort of as a thought experiment, regardless of how well they might actually work. At least you're trying something, I would say. Anyway, this is Love's Labor's Lost, though, play that no one knows.
Yeah, this is the first one, because he's done at this point. Hamlet, definitely Much Ado.
He did Richard, or was it Henry? I can never.
He did a history. Nobody cares.
Yeah, he did history. I don't care about it. Henry V. He did Henry V. Much Ado.
Some people care, but nobody really cares.
He did.
They have good speeches in them. Some people like them.
Yes, he was in Othello, but he did not direct an adaptation of Othello.
Wise choice.
Yes.
To not put himself in Othello.
No. He is in Othello. He didn't direct it, but he is not playing. Shall we say any question? There are no questionable casting choices. Lawrence Fishburne is in this movie, so don't worry.
He must be Iago, right?
Kenneth Branagh. Yeah, I'm sure he is. Who else?
Anyway. He's probably done. As You Like It might be after this, actually.
As You Like It is 06. This was like after this movie came out and kind of tanked both critically and financially. He took a bit of a breather and then came back with As You Like It.
As You Like It is good.
I've seen it. I remember liking it, but
I remember thinking it was fine, but I don't remember anything about it. Yeah.
This is definitely like a departure from like the mainstream.
Right.
He's skipped a lot of big ones. He hasn't done.
Mm-hmm.
Midsommar.
Kate. What's the one with Kates? Kiss Me, Kate.
Taming of the Shrew.
He didn't
do Kiss Me, Kate either, though. To be fair, could have done a movie version of Kiss Me, Kate. He chose not to.
Yeah, and he hasn't done Midsommar.
Yeah, it almost feels like he did like a handful of the big plays and was like, now let's try something that people don't know.
Which
very well.
I wonder if it's some sort of like, what's that bloke's name who's doing the Megalopolis?
Coppola.
It's some of a Coppola thing where he's like, what I really want to do is get to the plays that fucking no one knows about.
No one cares about.
But I have to.
I have to have like three hits of the big plays that people do know, and then I can start doing weird ass shit that no one's heard of.
And I can understand the logic in making that choice, because then, in theory, there's no expectations you have to play against.
Yeah.
And
sure.
But also, the other side of that is, like, maybe you're bored. Like, you don't want to do Midsommar. Like,
yeah.
What more are you going to add to the Midsommar?
Right, I mean, it also just feels sort of like, right, these plays have all been done by very talented actors and directors, so, like, maybe you want to give yourself a challenge.
Yeah.
The thing that it says on Wikipedia, and I've seen elsewhere online, is that in 84, he played the King of Navarre with the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Okay.
And then there is a essay by Harley Granville Barker, which I tried to find but could not, where he talks about how the language of Love's Labor's Lost is highly stylized and almost has a musical sense of rhythm to it, which made Kenneth Branagh think like, oh, what if it were just a flat out musical? What if it wasn't even just like we're talking in pentameter?
Right.
What if it was like a literal song that we jumped into? And so that sort of made him think, let's do that. Why not? So this is something that he's going like much further here in this than he's gone in any other Shakespeare movie that he's done. And since still.
Yeah. I mean, Much Ado is pretty straightforward, but well done. Hamlet also. I think.
Right. I mean, like the most you're doing really is like futzing with the settings and time periods. Sure. Aside from that, you're sticking pretty much to the text.
And again, same thing with As You Like It. It was just sort of straight down the middle, kind of just like a very normal presentation.
Yeah.
I do kind of see another like thematic connection, though, of kind of. If you're going to do a Shakespeare play, you know, Shakespeare is sort of like one of the oldest playwrights or writers that we still consider to be like powerful and present.
Centuries later, we still are looking at this guy and being like, what did he do right?
And I can see the thematic resonance of deciding to present that in one of the older, earlier film milieus. I get that. I think it's a cool idea. On paper, this sounds amazing.
Well, let's talk specifically about what he did do, because I don't feel like we've outright said what his choice was.
We kind of talked about it, we can move on to this.
So we'll throw in real quick that, like, before we go into that, like, this is one of Shakespeare's lesser known plays, obviously. It's a play that people might be familiar with by name, but by and large are not that familiar with as an actual play. It's a very simple, straightforward plot where it's basically like the king and his court decide to do No Nut November, and they're like, no one's gonna fuck with
3 years.
Yeah, 3 years of No Nut November. They're like, no one's gonna fuck with any ladies. We're all gonna sit around and study the entire time. It's going to make us a better, stronger kingdom. Mm-hmm. A bunch of women show up and they're like, hey there, can we talk about politics too? You're like, no! And they immediately start, like, getting horny for these women, and then decide to break their rule to not be horny, decide to be horny, and then the princess's father dies and she has to split. Yeah. That's basically it. Much of the play, if you have interest in the play, from what I'm gathering, it seems a lot of it comes from the language and the way it is written. Mm-hmm. People mostly talk about, like, the word play and the speeches and things like that. It's less about the plot. So if you were going to take a Shakespeare play and hack it down to 90 minutes, this feels like a play that could do that pretty easily, because, again, there's not a huge plot going on here. It's basically we do one thing, we meet some women, we decide to do another thing, and then they have to leave.
Yeah, there's not a lot of, like, character growth. Like,
right.
There's not a lot of arcs.
There's not a lot of, like, weird subplots or deceit where, like, characters are, you know, pretending to be other people. You have a little bit of that, obviously, still. But there's not a whole lot of, early on in the show, someone, like, lies to someone else, then it becomes the entire conflict of the show. Yeah. It's more just kind of an aside here, even, where it doesn't really affect anything all that much, frankly.
Yeah.
What he decided to do in addition to hacking it down to 90 minutes is he decided to add songs to it. And he made the choice to update the setting to the, I guess it'd be like
1940s?
What, yeah, like very, very early 1940s, yeah, possibly late 1930s.
40s.
Yeah.
I mean,
right as World War II.
History scholars will tell you it's the late 30s.
Yes. Right as World War II is starting to affect things in Europe. Mm-hmm. As things are already starting to go bad, the Nazis are on the move. So in addition to updating it to that time period, he also decided that the songs should be more or less era-appropriate songs from that time period. So you get a lot of Great American Songbook style songs, like I'd Rather Charleston, The Way You Look Tonight.
Yeah, The Way You Look Tonight, I Get a Kick.
Yeah, I Get a Kick Out of You. There's No Business Like Show Business. Basically, like, songs of that ilk are the songs that he chose. There's about 10 songs in here. Some of them fairly brief. Mm-hmm. Other ones are a little bit more involved.
Some just sort of, you kind of dip in and out real quick.
Well, I'd Rather Charleston is really the one that it feels like, you get like 90 seconds of it and he's like,
and
move on, yeah.
And then some of them go on, and I'm like, you didn't have to go on.
Yeah, no, some of them, like, I forget whatever the sexy dance song number is. I'm just a little bit like, okay, I get it.
I'll also say that I Won't Dance one is also blink and you miss it.
No, it is. Yes. Yeah, which one is I Won't Dance? I forget.
It's when they first arrive.
Don't ask me.
Oh, the,
like,
women.
Literally everyone gets a verse.
Oh, that's right. Then they just immediately learn. Like, yeah, that one also starts really oddly to me, too, where it's just like out of nowhere, they're all of a sudden like, won't dance.
Like, it's the three guys being like, hey, or the four guys being like, hey, can we see you tonight? No, can we see you tonight? Can we see you tonight? And then all of a sudden it's, I Won't Dance.
Yeah, yeah. And then, like, it just, as quickly as it begins, it goes.
Yeah. Did you get the feeling he didn't quite know how to begin or end a number?
I got the feeling that Kenneth Branagh is not a great director of musical sequences.
Yes.
Is what I got more so. I don't think he's bad at it, but I don't think he's great at it, is what I would say. There are times I think breaking into I Get a Kick Out of You, which is my favorite number in the show, incidentally, like, it starts the way songs generally start, where, like, you start with underscore building to it, and there's a very organic moment where what's his name? Don Armato?
Yeah.
Right, where Don Armato just, like, very naturally segues into I Get a Kick Out of You, and then it sort of, like, ends with a big, you know, production button, and then it stops. And it's like, yeah, that's what songs generally are in movie musicals. You get that. And then sometimes they just end abruptly, they start abruptly, or, like Lee said, we spend far too much time watching people writhe around.
I mean, I think that the intro, the Charleston one, starts abruptly, but it works for that scene, but then it stops way too soon, and I'm like, wow.
Because again, like, it is like a 90-second song snip, and it's kind of like, oh, this is your first song. You're cutting out this quickly instead of making a meal out of it, you know?
Yeah, and I also think that, like, maybe some, like, mashups would have served it a bit better, too, because, like, maybe you're, like, realizing 90 seconds in that, like, stretching the song to be about this to moment. Contextualize in this moment is hard.
Right.
We'll switch songs.
Right. No, exactly. Make a little medley. Just do whatever you want.
Do a medley.
Yeah.
Just move on to something else.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't have been unusual.
No, they're medley.
Certainly not.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of what I mean when I say I feel like Kenneth Branagh certainly seems like he's someone who's fascinated by musicals at this time, but movie musicals specifically of this time period. But I don't know that he knows how to do them or why some work and why some don't.
Correct.
I mean, there are things you were saying, Chris, even in the beginning, like the movie, the opening of the movie, you just sort of see still images over like velvet, like red velvet or something. Mm-hmm. And it's still frames of the movie where we'll show like Alessandro Nivola, and it's like the king played by Alessandro Nivola.
Which isn't really what they did at the time.
Right. Like it's almost what they did at the time.
The textured fabric. Right. The font of the credits. Yeah.
I mean, like accurate. There are so many movies of the time period where the credits are just, we wrote these names very nicely on a piece of paper, right, and someone will reach out and be like, away with this one.
If it had again been like just the names and the characters on the screen, or like part of a title sequence where it's art, where it's
a drawing of the character. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, people. Yeah.
That would have made sense. That would have felt authentic. But what doesn't feel authentic is, like, again, the literal still.
A literal screen cap of the movie, like, being showed. Yeah.
Screen cap on.
Yeah. Even if it was just someone's 8x10 glossy or something, you could be like, this is fine. This is acceptable.
It also, and we were talking about the writhing moment during, I can't even remember what song that was, but that's where it really hit me. And there were a few other points that it did too, where I'm like, he doesn't know how to move his camera for a musical, especially for a dance number.
I agree with that.
Doesn't know what to do with this camera in any
thing. Right. I mean, like, it's almost weird because I feel like in so many other movies, Branagh is relying so heavily on camera gimmicks to, like, make things look exciting. And here, it feels like he's trying to consciously mimic the sort of plant the camera and don't move it aesthetic of movies of the 1930s. But even movie musicals had, like, some movement involved. Like, you're not, like, cutting. I mean, the one song where he goes really nuts with it, again, is the Sexy Writhing song. It's, like, median shot length, 0.5 seconds, where you just keep cutting back and forth between people's hands groping each other. And that's where I'm like, this is not at all of the time period. This, like I said when we were watching it, feels like Fosse or even like Baz Luhrmann or something.
Or like, it would have been at home in like the Chicago movie adaptation or something.
Yes.
Like, so stylistically it didn't make any sense. Suddenly we're in a burlesque moment. Suddenly we're having a cabaret.
We're a very like modern day number in something that is striving to be era appropriate.
But then that individual shot is unsuccessful because it doesn't look like a choice. It looks like you're cutting people's bodies up in a way where it's confusing. Especially during a dance number, you want to see the whole body.
Like you said, like I think he's definitely making like a conscious choice here to zoom in on the like writhing bodies feeling each other. But again, it doesn't feel true to the spirit of the movie.
No.
It doesn't look particularly good because, again, you're just seeing a bunch of hands and bodies rubbing each other all over. So it just kind of ends up being a little bit of a dud.
It's a weird choice in general. I don't think it really matches the scene either.
Yeah.
It doesn't really, it's darker and it was like more like, I don't know, sultry and sexy. Just like, we're going to put masks on and pretend to be other people.
Right.
Could have been like a whimsical dance number.
It could have been like anything. Or like, you think also, if the whole gimmick is, we're going to put masks on so no one will tell us who we are, more attention will be played on the fact that they're sort of mismatched, but instead it's just kind of like everyone's just feeling each other
up. Yeah. What it really should have been is like something where they change partners a lot.
Right.
It's like, I was thinking
that it's like the men keep trying to get with the right woman and the women are like, we're ahead of you. And they keep like ducking away, like being coy the entire time. Like there are so many things you could have done with it, but instead it just ends up being a sexy number.
You do get the sense that he wouldn't been able to handle shooting that. If it were like a changing partner dance.
It could have literally been a waltz.
Yeah.
And you could have had a still camera and they switch partners.
Right.
And there's just like business and comic stuff around like some trying to peer around the
mask. Right. And then like another one pops up. It's like, it's me, the other one. And you're like, oh no, stuck with you.
Would be really at home in this movie where I think some of the theatrical flourishes are pretty successful.
Yeah.
One other just camera thing I wanted to throw in there. You pointed this out, Brendan, but they start, there's the Bubsy Berkeley moment with Nathan Lane.
Right, and there's
and
no business
they
like
bring
show
the
business.
Camera down as he looks up, and that really shouldn't happen unless he...
They keep cutting between. Like, first the camera pans up. In so many of the movies of the 30s and 40s, Bubsy Berkeley was fascinated by, like, the geometric patterns that dancers make when you view them from above, which obviously, like, is a conceit that only works in movies. In real life, if you saw a musical, and this is something where he's doing a backstage musical, and it's like, let's put on this number. In real life, if you were in the theater watching this, you'd be like, what the fuck are these people doing? They're all just like walking around in a circle, but like in the movie, the camera pans up. So you see like, oh, they're making like fantastic geometrical patterns.
Right.
And the camera then stays up there to watch them until they disperse and that part of it is over or something. In this version, it does angle up, and you look down to see Nathan Lane, like, staring up at the camera, singing the song while everyone else is doing their little...
Which feels like a mistake.
No, that's fine. I think it's fine that he looks... The thing that I think is weird is then you periodically cut back to a camera on the ground, and Nathan Lane is still looking up in the air as though the camera is there. That's like almost breaking, like, the rule of what you're doing in this. Like, it feels like that's almost like something you would do if you were doing a metatextual take on this sort of a number, to be like, isn't it ridiculous that this guy is looking up into the air and they're all doing a geometric pattern that we on the ground can't even begin to wrap our heads around? But the fact is, he's still doing that number, and then occasionally he is still cutting to the ground for no real reason. Like, it's not like you're getting anything more out of it by seeing this character on a ground level. So,
it's
like,
weirdly close.
That's what I just find very strange, frankly.
I have a legit question.
Yeah.
And you're allowed... I'm just being sort of annoying person advocate.
What else is new?
Well, that's my job.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think people back in the 30s were actually like, their camera wouldn't be there in real life?
No.
Nobody cared, right?
Yeah, no. I'm sure it was just, like, again, it's literally just a conceit to make an interesting visual image. Yeah. I'm sure people in the audience weren't like, well, that's silly.
It was just... busy worrying about if the train's going to hit them.
Right, exactly. Right.
But we're not that audience.
Whenever the princes are coming out of their boats, they should be thinking, oh, no, there's no water here. They're going to sail right out into the audience.
No, but, like... It's silly to us now, and we're like, yeah, that doesn't make sense as a choice because it's, like...
No, and I realize also that it's one of those things where, like, if you're doing it well, I don't care. Like, if you're doing it well and you're not calling attention to the sort of weirdness and the artificiality of it and just sort of, like, going all in on it, it's perfectly fine. It's the weird fact that he keeps cutting between, like, the ground-level camera and the camera
again,
in the sky.
I think a lot of this I want to couch not as, like, an excuse, but just as, like, I don't think we've pointed it out, that this seems like quite a low-budget movie.
Yes,
which it is.
And so I feel like, because we've talked a lot about how bad a lot of the choreography is and how unsynced people are, that, like, maybe they didn't have a lot of time to work this shit.
I mean, I am almost positive that it is definitely a big part of it, right?
Yeah.
This, I think...
I literally wonder if there was just two cameras. Like, I'm gonna get Nathan's face from above.
Right, we just have to plant these two cameras. We're doing the scene, like, once, and we just have to hope for the best.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, this was, I think, a $12 million budget, which is obviously certainly not a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, so I think also that they had 3 weeks to do sort of, like, a musical theater boot camp, which, again, if you are not a theater performer, that is a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
Like, high schools give you more time to learn a spring musical than this would afford you to do a movie musical. So I definitely get, you know, the sloppiness as part of the fact that, well, they simply did not have the time and money. That being said, there are such minor things that they could have done where, you know, when they're doing the sort of Esther Williams number of all the girls in the pool, the women are, like, flailing their arms around, not at the same time as each other. And it was just so easy to have someone standing behind the camera, sort of, like, counting with their hand, being like, left arm, right arm. And, like, if they are doing that, then half the cast isn't paying attention. It's the same thing when they're doing There's No Business Like Show Business and everyone's entering doing, like, the little hand thing. Like, the woman who plays Holofernian, I know she's an older woman, but she's completely off with everyone else. And it's just like...
I don't think I've ever seen you this nitpicky over.
I mean,
not a bad
way.
I'm not saying it's unjustified. I'm just saying, like, I think
it activated something.
Yeah, it did.
Like, you've really, like, you can tell that this has, like, really gotten under
it. It does. I think it's just one of those things when, like, if you love this medium and want to do an homage to this so much, you're doing so many things so sloppily that it just riles me up a little
bit. It does also maybe go to the idea of not only the low budget part, but the go, 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 the maybe not so much time part, because a lot of those are like, well, just do another take. Just reset, have a conversation with the actor who's out of sync, start it again. But if you just don't have time, I guess you're just like, well, fuck it. We just have to...
I imagine everything's tight, right? Like, shooting time, everything.
Yeah, and again, like, some of these people were, like, pretty big actors at the time, so I'm sure they had other places they had to be in, commitments they had. So I do get it. I definitely appreciate the fact that this movie was done on a low budget very quickly. That being said, I still think it looks sloppy in ways that could have been preventable versus sloppy in the ways that you kind of allow because of time or money.
Can we briefly imagine what would it have been like if he picked a different musical style from a different era and then had to do it in that era?
Like disco?
Disco would be fun.
Like, what about...
An 80s mega musical?
What about 80s rock hair metal?
Yeah.
80s hair metal.
I almost...
punk scene.
I almost feel like that would be too far from Kenneth Branagh's taste.
It would be too...
It almost
Kenneth
feels like...
Kenneth Branagh doesn't know anything.
Right. It almost feels like Kenneth Branagh's, like, understanding of pop culture stuff in the 1950s or something.
I would die to see
You could
him
have,
do.
Like, a Grease style one, though.
You could.
No, absolutely.
That would work.
That's not insane. That's, like, not an insane idea.
Because I think something that I think to Brenna's credit, he is recognizing that because the story, the play itself, is so skeletal, there is so much space to put in a big swing when it comes to the style, the setting, the whatever.
Right.
I put it to you, it's Greece and it's like over a summer, and so that's why they have to wait a year. Because
I think that's,
that works. At like the beach for the summer.
Right. And I think like one of the issues I also do have with this movie, I think, and maybe it's because the play itself is so like slight in nature, that grafting World War II onto it really bogs down the proceedings in a way I don't quite enjoy.
Yeah, and I considering they had her dad die anyway, I don't know.
Why the Nazis had to be like approaching France at the same time. When we were talking during the movie, you had said something about how, like, well, obviously, like, in real life, there are movies that were shot at this time period and incorporate the war.
Yeah.
That is, like, 100% unquestionable. Like, even, you know, a movie that I like, Christmas in Connecticut, opens with one of the characters who has just been on a boat that was shot by a German submarine and is now stranded on a lifeboat. And then the rest of the movie is, like, a frivolous Christmas comedy.
Yeah. And so you have, like, what's that movie with Cary Grant where he has to pretend to be a woman?
Didn't even White Christmas have a...
Yeah, I mean, again, yeah, White Christmas starts in Europe during World War II.
Right.
And this is, like, I understand that, you know, World War II, obviously, horrible time for everyone.
Yeah.
It's not exactly a new concept that a movie is taking a kind of frivolous story and grounding it in the reality of World War II, because this is certainly a thing that happened in Hollywood at that time. The argument I think that I would kind of make about it is the idea that
I was a male war bride.
I don't think he has a one,
but I think it's like he has to be, it's something like that.
Okay, I have never seen that one, but I know the name. I think that was something my parents had on VHS tape.
It's a funny title.
Yes, it is a very funny title. I think the concept of like the transitioning this to a different time period, the major issue that I have with it, going off of kind of what I said earlier, and I mean, I'm not even talking about like the logistics of it, all the fact that there were no French princesses at this time period, like I don't even care about shit like that, but it does kind of feel, comparing this to something like Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, where he at least had the smart idea to recast the Capulets and Montagues as like mob bosses slash like large corporation owners. Like he really comes up with an idea as to like who these people would be at that time and presents them as that. Where in this one is very straightforward, like, no, she's still a princess. He's still the king. And like, I'm not saying that I necessarily have a better concept for that. I'm just saying that you could go in a different direction. But regardless of all of that, I think living in the present day, it's very easy to sort of see how people in the past would unequivocally look at World War II and be like, we are good and we are doing good things, which to be fair, by and large, you know, we're trying to stop worse things from happening. So I can agree with that. However, it's one of those things where you looking at it through a modern lens in retrospect, you realize this was a lot more horrible than we actually thought at the time. We were by and large not aware of the like how horrible the Holocaust was for a long period of time. It's kind of one thing to have this sort of rah-rah jingoistic like America good guys look of the 1940s versus if you look at it through a modern context, studying it in the past, you almost have that emotional baggage of knowing like this is a far shittier situation than even you guys were aware of at the time. And that's what I kind of have an issue with. I feel like that drags down this very light, very fluffy text and really kind of pummels it into a dark place that I don't care for. Every time we cut to a scene where like someone's listening to the radio being like, Hitler's moving in on France, I'm like, oh God, like, just, like Jesus Christ, we don't need that. So like the frivolity of this, I think, is at odds with what Kenneth Branagh wanted to do with the time period setting. I think it'd be perfectly fine to reset this. Lee, I think it was you who said a fictionalized European country in the 1930s where the real world is not affecting it in any way, where you could still have this be a movie set in the 1930s using the songs from this time period because you love those songs so much and any songs after the 40s don't exist. And that could be perfectly okay. But the mere fact that he is trying to ground this in a reality. And again, Lee, wasn't it you who had just said it is enough that her father dies at the end that you have to leave.
They didn't stop her father from dying.
Right.
They just added that it's World War II. And I'm like, why?
Right. No, the play already says we have to leave because my dad died and there is a year of mourning. And like you can say as a modern audience, you can be like, well, that's kind of dumb. And sure, it is fine. But you don't need to also be like, and we have to go because France has fallen.
Or just like find another option. Because there would have been other ways. Like, again, I just came up with one for the Beach Boys one, where it's the summer home.
You
have to go back to our New York.
We're in California, but you're from Oklahoma and we're from New York, whatever.
So you could have just found something else. But because, I mean, there are no shortage of like comedies and wacky movies from the 30s. which, by the way, is still probably the Great Depression in America.
Yeah.
But that are not about the war as well.
Yes.
They don't have anything to do with the war wasn't a thing yet.
Right.
Or, it, you know, there are plenty of times. That's kind of why people went to the movies then anyway, is mm-hmm. because it sucked.
An escape.
Yeah. It's because the real life sucked. So, yeah, if you wanted to, I think that, yeah, in general, the choice to have it be with World War II is bizarre if you're only going to use it sort of at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then because you're doing it at the end, you have these weird times you see it through these, like, newspaper headlines.
Yeah.
It's like, that's weird, man.
Right.
Because I never noticed really before we was watching it this time around of, like, man, they're really just, like, seeding doom.
Characters will, like, throw down newspapers, and the newspaper is, like, Poland falls, Europe is under attack.
Yeah.
Even the footage at the end where you see, like, all these people in World War II, some of them are the more simple movie versions of what you'd expect, like, Holofernes digging ditches or whatever, and where they are. And then you also have that one guy getting shot. Who is it? Who's in, like, a prisoner of war camp? Yeah, Don Armato is, like, in a fucking prisoner of war camp while his wife and child are, like, watching him be let off. And that's, like, at that moment, I'm just like, this movie is ending. You can't throw this out at me with like 5 minutes left of this movie to be like, and the war was awful. I get that the war was awful. If you're gonna do this, have it be the whole thing or don't have it at all. And I think because, again, the source material is so light and fluffy, you can't have it be such an omnipresent force in the story if you want to still make it just like a sort of dumb, aw shucks, gee whiz, we thought we could say no to women but we really can't kind of comedy.
I'm also sure that there was, Kenneth Branagh had a thing about wanting to keep as much of the original dialogue as possible. Like, I'm sure there's only things cut or maybe paraphrased, but not fully subbed out for something.
Well, the only thing that's subbed out, I'm sure, is the newsreel footage. I'm pretty sure everything else in there is normal, but then every now and then you have Kenneth Branagh interject and be like, golly gee, look what's going on at Navarre.
I guess what I was just wishing for was maybe the war stuff would have played better if that was reflected in the dialogue at all, but if that wasn't on the table to write new original dialogue to make that make sense, then I kind of felt like he should have chosen between dad dying and the war, because the war doesn't add anything until it's just an extra excuse to split them up.
I want to talk about the plot in general, and the sort of choices, adaptation choices, and the cutting that was made. This is a silly play.
It is. Mm-hmm.
It is about four chuckleheads who decide that they're going to, like, buckle down and study, and then instantly that falls apart.
Right.
No girls allowed!
No girls allowed. Only one guy is, like, brave enough to be like, hey, this seems stupid.
Yeah, hey, we're very horny.
We're horny, and also, like, a lot of those stipulations are just straight-up nonsense.
Right.
Right. Like, what is it like? You have to eat, like, mush, and you sleep 3 hours?
Just sleep 3 hours, and you're not allowed to yawn. Which sounds like such a, like, a boy's sleepover thing.
Yeah, no, it does. It's also, to be fair, this is also one of those weird-ass things where I'm like, if I was in this court and the king was, like, imposing all these rules on people, I'd be a little concerned, frankly, more than anything else.
The thing is, the play starts with this, but, like, if the king is a character that we're supposed to care about, I need to know why this is.
I agree.
Something had to
happen. They don't motivate it.
Right.
To put this in the
game. Well, right, because the movie adds a thing where, like, he's back from maneuvers and he's decided to study, and it's like.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he was practicing for military service as the war is approaching, then said, fuck it, I need to study for 3 years instead.
Yeah.
How does that track?
Trying to get punched as a subjector.
I guess so, right?
Trying to dodge draft.
Yeah, I'm also a Quaker now. Yeah.
I think you're right. If it were motivated, that would make a lot more sense.
Yeah, and but it's just, like, really in the play, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, I think also in the play, it's literally just, again, with no outside pressures around whatsoever, with everything going right in the world, he can be like, I think it would be really great if my court decided to study very hard for 3 years to become a better court.
Yeah.
I think that's, like, perfectly valid. When you, again, throw this World War II thing out, it's sort of war is at your front door, and you're basically being like, but wouldn't it be cool if I took 3 years off to study for a while?
The thing is, there's a lot of characters and not a lot of them do a lot.
Yeah.
Right. So that's,
like,
certainly true.
There's four guys and four girls, but really only two guys and two girls matter.
I mean, also, Natasha McElhone also really doesn't matter that much
either.
Really, like, she matters because she is Kenneth Branagh's girl in the movie, but she doesn't really do much.
It's really, like, it's really the King and Barone show, I would say, for the most of it. And then there was, like, even more servants in the play that don't do anything, really, that you can kind of trim down. But the sort of side plots involved are basically this plot with, like, Jack Winnetta and Costard and Don Armato, where, like, Costard is first caught fooling around with Jack Winnetta.
Right.
Yep.
And then Don Armato is like, bad.
Yes, I'm turning you in. Yes, but secretly. Yeah.
Like, I love her, and I'm going to get her, and he kind of does get her.
Yeah, it's really weird that Castard, I guess, just was only doing it for shits and giggles, right? So he doesn't really care. But again, because you can't write any sort of new text, you can't really explore these moments that well. Because you just have to sort of pave over with acting choices.
Because he happily delivers a message to Jack Mineta from Don Armato later.
Right.
He doesn't seem broken up about, but I was flirting with her.
Which is why I also thought it was intentional at first, but I think maybe he just legitimately mixed the letters up.
Yeah.
He's a silly little fool.
You could argue that might be an interesting choice to make. You know, if it's one of those trademark wise fools where the fool is the one who's like, I know how to make this all better for everyone. I'll have those horny men get laid by switching these letters around. It's one of those, again, Shakespearean classic plot contrivances where someone gets a letter they're not supposed to get. Yeah. But it doesn't matter in this version. It really doesn't. As soon as we find out that Barone sent a letter to Natasha McElhone being like, I fucking want you so bad. Everyone's like, shouldn't have done that. And he's like, but I'm horny. And they're like, so are we. The king, for whatever dumbass reason, made this rule that we all have to not nut and study for 3 years, and then all of a sudden he's like, that was dumb of me.
It's sort of just an excuse plot, really, for hijinks.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And the hijinks don't even go that deep.
That's what I'm saying. So you're thinking about Wise Fool. I would say if that letter choice, if that switch up mattered more, I would say that, maybe Custard could be argued to be one of the smart fools, but I think...
Oh, no, he's not. He's 100%
an idiot.
Right, yeah. He 100% does not intend to...
It doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you also have a similar thing with the plot where, again, who's the gay guy?
Boye. He doesn't really do... Again, he's kind of got, a lot of characters in him.
Yes.
He's a combination.
He's sort of just on the periphery, though.
He's basically, the sounding board to move the plot along a
little bit. Yeah, and he occasionally delivers a message.
He's the princess's one, though.
So, for the princess. So, there's also the sort of little contrivance at the end where he shows up and talks to the princesses, and he's like, those guys are going to come over here and wear masks, so you can't tell who's who. And they're like, well, we'll wear masks too, and they won't be able to tell who's who either. And then they have a sexy dance, and the girls are like, let's pretend that those guys we just danced with, and we don't know that it's them, and let's pretend they were fucking dummies. And it's going to be so hilarious. And they're like
trash talk.
Right. They're like, boy, they said so much shit and yet so very little. Like, boy, they fucking sucked. Glad they're gone. And all the men are like, should we tell her? And it's like, they tell her, and no one cares. There are little plot wrinkles that amount to nothing in this.
There's no impact to it.
No, it's basically like, kind of this puppy love-esque thing where it's just all of these guys and girls doing silly little hijinks.
A bunch of little guys cackling and going tee-hee.
Yeah, it's got guys and girls cackling and going tee-hee.
Yes.
It's just not one of
Shakespeare's
best.
Classic tee-hee plays. Tragedies, comedies, histories, and tee-hees.
Yep. So no one really learns anything by the end, except that was a stupid idea in the first place.
Right.
Don't do it.
Which is just, again, such a weird lesson. You know, it's not a bad idea to try and learn shit, but...
Okay, I will say that Shakespeare does try to say some stuff at some point. There is a speech Barone has, which I joked about a little bit, but Barone kind of tries to say when they're all caught out for falling in love with a woman while they're doing this thing that, this is foolish, we can't improve ourselves without women, we need women, blah, 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 they're part of the world or whatever. I joke that it really just kind of comes across as but I'm too horny.
Yes.
Yeah.
He
needs his book.
You do get the sense that he's trying to dress up I'm horny with more intellectualized highfalutin language.
Yeah.
It is a highfalutin kind of a speech, and there are, it sounds nice, but it does kind of amount to, gotta have,
gotta have my sex.
Can't think about studying if I don't bone.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that. And then there's some interesting stuff there where the play ends just as similarly, but less dramatically because there's no World War II shit.
Yes.
Which is an unceremonious, we have to go because my dad died. I got to go mourn.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens in the movie too, where they get these assignments. All of the guys get a task from the ladies. Mm-hmm. We sat there and listened to it, but we're all kind of done with the movie by this
point. Yes.
They've had a montage.
We know her dad's dead and she's like, I got a split. I have a year of mourning. Yeah. I have to go. And then everyone still has a conversation with their girlfriend.
Yeah. But I feel like there's stuff there that is interesting, but not done enough with, where it's maybe if the play wasn't just a silly comedy, that would be a lesson to impart with the different characters, tasks would have something to do with them. But Barone's is weird and arbitrary because we're talking about his task, make sick people, make people
make
who
people
need
laugh.
To laugh laugh.
Yeah.
And it's like,
what about him makes you think he's funny?
Why is that his job?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be for Costard? Really?
Yeah.
Right, Costard the fucking clown.
Yeah, because I just imagine Barone being like, wait a minute, is that what you think I
right,
am?
Yeah, you
am
think
comic relief?
Yeah, am I a joke to you?
Am I a joke to you?
Instantly a better movie. It takes just, that hard left
it's
turn.
It's like a boy band thing where it's like, I thought I was the
smart right, one. I thought I was the cute one. They're like, yeah, no, you're the goofball.
No, you're the goofball.
No woman wants to sleep with you. I wonder also, part of like how we mentioned briefly, Lee, you had said the ending, how it feels like it takes fucking forever to wrap up. It almost feels like the sort of simple, and I know maybe this is just part of the inherent issue of condensing a, you know, 3-hour play into a 90-minute movie, or maybe it's just the fact that the play is so slight it resists any attempts to have a sort of structure imposed upon it.
Yeah.
But it almost feels like the king dying should be like end of act two moment, and then all of act three is everyone deciding what to do. Because here it feels almost like the king has died and you're like, okay, we've got like 5 minutes left, right? But then it's like, no, we have like 20 minutes left at this point.
Yeah. I almost would say, I don't know how far people go with adapting Shakespeare, but I think there's an argument to be made for moving all of those task assignments to before the king dying.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Because, and also, like, my understanding is that Kenneth Branagh did reshuffle some of the scenes. Yeah. So if you're already doing that, why would you not have the innate sense to look at this and be like, we got to wrap this up quicker?
Yeah. Like, I don't know, the idea that, like, these women are like, all right, joke's over, we'll date you, but you got to do all this cool shit first.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, hold on that.
Right. That should almost happen during the party or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
it could give the party some... Because in the movie, the party is literally just an excuse for Nathan Lane to have a song, and then it ends. Because you also even see... like a quick newsreel of other shit that people have apparently done at this party, where like Holofernia has like a drama mask on and Don Armato is like doing something with the sword. Like, it almost feels like you could have this shit going on stage and then cut to them in the audience having these little conversations with each other. And that allows you to sort of indulge in some of these goofy antics, but also actually gives you plot or character.
Just, I know he wanted to get his war movie back in there, but I would have just done away with the whole ending montage. I don't need it.
I mean,
away from the mansion, we're out. Yeah. I don't see why we need to dive back into this.
See, so it's kind of generally agreed that there is a sequel to this play that has been lost that provides actual closure. Not called Love's Labor's Found, which I think is better, but Love's Labor's Won. I understand the inclination to sort of wrap things up, because the play literally just ends with them being like, we'll see you in a year. Bye. Like, I feel like you do kind of need something to cap it off there. I think it goes on for too long, but I do think that his inclination to show, again, since he's fucking married to this war, to show the war happened, the war progressed, the war end, VE Day, and then show them all united together makes sense. Again, I think it's done badly. I hate that you don't see them sort of getting back together even at the end. They just sort of run to each other and get in for a photo, and then the movie ends. You should be seeing these people like crying and kissing and love. It should be about love, but instead it's just sort of like, oh, hey, there you are. Cool. Nice to see you.
We get to
you
see.
You know what I would love? Oh, sorry.
Some labor's lost.
We get to see a baby with a mustache.
Yeah, you do. That's true. You do get to see little Pubert from the Addams Family.
Yeah. I would love if Love's Labor's One was like unexpectedly dramatic sequel to Love's Labor's Lost.
That'd be
like
funny.
People back in the day were like, oh, what a silly comedy that was. I can't wait to
hear to laugh at part two.
Yeah, and it's like, is that like 5 or 7 years later and everyone's older and sadder and like,
everyone hates each other.
Yeah, there's just a lot of like, it's just like a big, sort of David Mutt.
I just love the idea that someone involved in the play like found the only copy, was like, rips, sets fire to it, is like, and no one will ever know the horrible ending of Love Labor's One.
The choice to have it be a sort of light movie musical screwball style comedy is good, because it covers for the fact that there's like very little happening in the story. And I think that they kind of falter on that a couple times, where it drifts into something different. Like, again, you said they got like something that's too theatrical and it's staged.
Right. I mean, like, I think like some of the comedy is very fun.
Yeah.
Like the scene where they're all kind of hiding, but they're not hiding very well, but they're all just too like in love to realize that someone is literally crouching under the table behind a pot of plants.
I liked that. That was fun. Like, theatrical.
And then
business.
You have a weird bit at the end where Kenneth Branagh pops up from behind a bookcase and is like, hi, King! And the King goes like, and falls on his back.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that's, again, playing to the cheap seats. Nathan Lane, an actor whom I like a lot, I think sometimes goes very full ham in this movie. Mm-hmm. And again, that is a director's fault, not an actor's fault. I love the idea that Costard is a vaudeville performer. I think that's a terrific idea for
great
who this character should be. But there's just so much like goofy, and like, especially when he's like making like honking noises or pulls a bunch of handkerchiefs out. It's like, you can do those things a little bit, but then it starts to be like, okay, I get it. You were pulling the letter out and you pulled out a rubber chicken instead. That's very funny.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
Well, let's also move on from the plot.
Yeah.
And talk about the characters.
The characters.
The characters.
And how they were acted out by the players of this movie.
Who do you want to start with?
Well, you start with, who else would you start with on Kenneth Branagh production?
Let's start with Ken.
Good old KB.
Yeah. Our old buddy KB. Back again.
Was he Kenneth?
He was more than Knuff.
He is. Kenneth Branagh is always more than Knuff.
He's good in this.
I had said this earlier. I do think he reads as slightly older than the
yes.
others, which I don't think.
He for sure does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know you said, Lee, that like
anyone.
That's fine for you. And I agree. I don't think this is like an inherently bad thing, but it does read a little bit like dad and like his son's friends.
I don't think it reads like dad. I do think it reads like weird uncle.
I mean, the thing, yeah. Okay, that's fair. The thing that like. Chris, I don't know if you know this, but what? Years ago, Barbra Streisand did an album of theater songs.
Okay.
And one of the songs she did was At the Ballet from A Chorus Line, which I don't know if you know. But
yeah.
So, but it's just three women talking about like,
sure.
My life sucked in this way, but at the ballet, everything was great.
Right.
And Barbra Streisand, because she's a lunatic and very talented, both can be true, Kenneth, she adds this like prelude where, you know, it's her talking to the other women being like, oh, hey, we're showing up for this audition. Like, I hope it goes great. Now, one of them is Barbra Streisand, who is like 70-something. The other two women are Anne Hathaway and Daisy Ridley. So in your head, you're just imagining all of a sudden, like, Anne Hathaway and Daisy Ridley are sitting around being like, God, I hope one of us gets cast for this. And Barbra Streisand shows up, be like, hey gals, which one of us do you think is going to be right for this part? Grandma, go to bed.
Right.
And I realize that is like an extreme version of that, but it's very difficult for me to, on some level, not look at this and be like, you do look older than the rest of your boys.
Yeah.
It is hilarious in the Barbra Streisand case specifically that it's like, yeah, they for sure all go out for the same role.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
Like someone got their cards crossed at some point.
I think it's like maybe the reason why this is probably the last one he starred in as.
I might be inclined to agree. It does feel sort of, well, he is, I think, doing King Lear off Broadway next season, so that almost feels like maybe Kenneth Branagh is like maturing into a different stage of his Shakespeare career, right, where you get to play like the older characters now.
Yeah. I mean,
so like maybe Kenneth Branagh is realizing that just because you're not playing the hot young guy, it doesn't mean that you have no value here.
I think I prefer him in a more dramatic mode, so I bet he'd be good in that.
Yeah, I'm sure he would too. I mean, I have no inclination really to see it, but you know,
I like King Lear. It's a good play.
Yeah,
I'd go see Kenny B. That if he doesn't.
Yeah, me too.
But I do agree. I think his performance is fine generally. I think like we said before, he gets Shakespeare. Like this man understands Shakespeare. This man has spent his life studying Shakespeare. I think he's a pretty decent singer.
Mm-hmm.
I've got no beef with him as far as that goes.
I mean, I thought kind of everyone had more or less a pretty okay to decent voice.
Meh. Yeah, so I don't know what else I have to say about Kenneth Branagh's performance, really.
He's
like,
good.
I mean, clearly, guy knows Shakespeare.
I don't know that you leave the movie and you're like, oh my god, what a performance.
No, I mean, again, to be fair, again, probably because this is a very slight play. It's not the sort of play that's like an actor's showcase.
You're not really going to see a lot of...
True.
No one's like making a meal out of these things.
True.
What's his name? The guy that plays Ferdinand?
Alessandro Nivola.
Yeah,
did you know that he is not credited as Ferdinand anywhere in the movie, despite the
just
fact that
king?
That is his name? Yeah.
Weird.
Didn't know that.
He's minimized anyway. I like Alessandro Nivola in this fine also. I think I said when we were watching this, he has a very era-appropriate look to him. He's got the pomaded hair. He has a very handsome, angular face.
He does, yeah.
He
has almost like a falconish quality to
Yes,
his...
aquiline, yes.
Yes.
Nose.
Yes.
Yeah.
He, again, I think he sings pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No
I mean, I think to be fair, a lot of these actors were going to walk away from being like, did good
fine.
Work.
Who do we feel needed help?
Who do we feel needed help?
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I think... I don't want to be cruel, but I think there is one performer in particular who feels adrift in this movie. And God bless her. I think she certainly tries.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's doing as best she can.
Yep.
Just because you're a good actor at other things doesn't mean you're a good actor in all things. That's perfectly fine. I'm not knocking her talents. Yes. It's just some people aren't suited for it. Alicia Silverstone is not suited for it.
Nope.
Yeah.
Again, as we said, it feels very high school acting where she understands that she needs to like modulate her voice up and down to make it sound like she's saying things and understands what's going on. But in real life, it's just sort of, she's just shifting the volume of her voice because she knows that you have to do it.
It's a different flavor of Keanu Reeves and Much Ado.
Yes.
It's different flavors of like high school doing Shakespeare. Where Keanu Reeves is like, I'm just gonna sound serious and not
if I sound dour and serious, it will cover for me not getting this.
Yeah, and then Alicia Silverstone is like, the kid reading in class and being like, and then he said this.
Right.
And he was very
right. And she like, it's the idea that she's a bubbly princess, so she should probably sort of, you know, say things like this.
She sort of pitches her voice up occasionally too, and I'm just like, ooh.
Yeah, I think her singing is kind of the worst. To be fair, I feel like a lot of them you don't really hear the other women sing all that much. Like, they occasionally get a line or two.
Yeah.
But I do feel like when Alicia Silverstone begins whatever the fuck that number is with all the gals in the tent, her voice is bizarrely high-pitched and chirpy in a way that I find extremely grating.
And I wondered if it was meant to be a period touch.
I think she's, like, a choice is being made to sound sort of
like a Betty Boop voice.
Right, to sound like sort of excessively girly and chirpy.
Right.
I think that's what she's doing, because there are other times where she sings in songs with other people and you hear her for a line or two and I'm like, oh, that's fine.
It's like normal.
Right, yeah. It sounds like how a person might sound if they were singing, but there, for some reason, as soon as you get to her sort of doing that sort of shtick, you've lost me for this number.
The thing it made me kind of realize was like, wow, a lot of Alicia Silverstone is in Cher Horowitz of Clueless.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, it feels like she was sort of...
There's so much Cher in her performance.
I mean, I think that's one of those things where every now and then you find an actor who is so perfectly suited for a role because they are that role to some extent. I'm not saying that she's entirely Cher. That's reductive. I'm certain there's some skill involved there. But it's just one of those things where, like, this was perfect. This was a perfect casting fit. And anything beyond that, you're just sort of fine at best.
I just think that she's got a really distinct voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard not to hear that.
Yes.
And it feels displaced in this movie.
If I can maybe compare her to someone else who I think does also typically not work in this kind of setting, with one very notable exception, is Drew Barrymore. I also think that she would not...
She's the same kind of voice.
Yes.
Yeah, it is a similar
thing.
It's
very childish. It's a little bit baby dollish. And there's a cadence that she just cannot shake. Now, the one exception to that is Ever After.
I was
going to
say Ever After, yeah.
But... I could see her making the same mistakes in this.
I mean,
it doesn't fit.
Like we said, it's the sort of like, this person has a face that's seen an iPhone.
Yes.
Like, this is a woman who like clearly belongs in modern times.
Yeah.
And anytime you're putting her in a period, again, like when she was in the fucking vampire movie, Amy Heckerling's vampire movie. Right, Vamps. Like, this is just such awful casting to see her in the scenes where she's trying to be, you know, a Puritan woman, right?
Oh, that's right.
It just makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, then you have people like Matthew Lillard, who, like, if not great, I think does a pretty good job in this movie.
Yeah.
Again, at, you know, pretty decent singing. He moves well. I think, you know, he's not asked to do a whole lot because he barely has a character, but he sounds like he understands what he is saying and is communicating it in an interesting way.
He serves, like, fun facial expressions. He has a fun physicality.
Yeah.
He finds some things to do. I wish Adrian Lester did. He kind of disappears.
Yeah, I mean, Adrian Lester has the advantage of being the only one who's a professional singer-dancer. So, like,
his voice is great.
Right, so he sounds good and you see him dance well. Like, you see him in the scene where they're all hiding and he's doing the thing where he's, like, walking on the chairs and they're falling down. It's clearly one of those things where it's like, oh, right, this guy can actually dance. So let's do the entire number around him.
Yeah. Anyone else?
Nathan Lane.
Lane is fun. It's a good choice that they did. I will say one thing with the character of Boyer is that they condense a lot of the speaking servants down into Boyer, but they also give Boyer like a lot of just screen time to just have business and stuff, which I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
And it made him feel like a much more developed character, multidimensional character than a guy whose job is pretty much to deliver messages.
And I also thought I wish the movie had more of this, but it was an interesting element in the movie to have an observer that we get to see his reaction to what's happening.
Yeah.
I always find that really interesting, because then if you take that thing away, it feels very weird. Like, why aren't we addressing people outside of that circle?
Yeah.
Like, how does this look in the world?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there are other characters that are not involved, like, directly involved, or either are kind of, like, just kind of dumb. The
Dull.
Guy that's literally named Dull.
Yeah.
Constable like,
Dull or whatever.
Yeah,
they're just, like, non-involved. Like,
right.
Sort of school teacher people.
Right. They're almost barely characters. And I think, in theory, the idea of gender swapping one of the characters is interesting, but because it does so little with it, it doesn't really matter.
Yep.
It kind of implies that they're both into each other, but you don't really see a whole lot of it. If they ended the number being like, but we're good friends, you'd be like, yeah, they are.
But it feels like maybe a choice they did just because they wanted them to have a song.
Yeah, no, it does. It does feel like that too. And I mean, again, also Chris had said it's weird that the way you look tonight takes place during the daytime. And I know that I'm sure Kenneth Branagh wrote it at night, thinking of Natasha McElhone at night. But it should take place sort of at night, I think.
I also think it's weird when they get all dolled up and then they have that dance number of like coming out of the doors and stuff. That should be at night. Why it's in like full daylight is so weird to me.
I just want to really briefly, I think, talk about some of the musical numbers real quick. I know we kind of have a little bit here to begin with. There are, I think, some very effective musical numbers in here. Like, I love, as I said, I Get a Kick Out of You, which that's might be my favorite one, where you get to see Timothy Spall like flying in a plane and like throwing champagne and like blowing cocaine in Moth's face.
He has like a crazy Salvador Dali mustache. He has a crazy outfit.
Right.
It's clownish. It's big. It's also, as you pointed out earlier, the only what I would identify as like a traditional musical number.
And I would also say the women's song that I don't like very much, which segues into sort of a wannabe Esther Williams ballet, should in theory be something like that. But because it comes off as kind of sloppy, it doesn't quite work. I get what he's going for here. And also, is it Cheek to Cheek, I think, where the men like start to fly?
Yep.
But again, like, they fly, like, into the ceiling of the library, and you see them, like, with the celestial backdrop of the ceiling behind them, and then, like, we're back in the courtyard, and we're just dancing with women, and the number's done. And it's just, like, you had the opportunity to do some, like, big, interesting things with some of these numbers, and you so often just resort to, we're dancing with each other in the courtyard. And in some of the group numbers, even, it's not even dancing, it's just people sort of sashaying back and forth in the way you look tonight. Mm-hmm. Nathan Lane, and I think Moth, and who's the woman who Nathan Lane is with? I forget her name.
Jacquelina.
Yeah, but they're like, the two old people are singing the song, they're just like doing this back and forth in the background. It's just like, this is it. Like, this is all you have for us during this number. You like recognize that people need to move, but all you're doing is just a lot of sashaying back and forth.
This has somehow become choreography part two.
Yes, it has. We can stop it now.
All right, we've probably been talking a while about this movie. We should probably
get to transition
out and talk about fixes. Yeah. Who wants to go first?
Me.
Go ahead.
Mine's very simple. You actually kind of mentioned something a little earlier that overlapped a bit with you had the Beach Boys idea. Mine's not exactly Beach Boys, but it's in a similar vein. I was trying to think of other just eras of like movie musicals, but also just like what were like eras of film of film genre and like style and look and aesthetic that were like really like kind of like poppy and big and maybe similarly like this is retro as were his choices in this.
Right.
So my thought was it would be a like 60s style surfer musical, like Gidget kind of thing. And then it is like people from one side of the tracks are at this beach house. People from the other side of the tracks are at this beach house. And I kind of think you can just... I guess the way I was thinking about it was less like, what would I change about the story? And just more like, what would I change about the presentation?
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing that I was thinking about, all due respect to Kenneth Branagh's choice to go for the Old American Songbook. I think that worked for what he was trying to do. I think I want to have like kind of like Beach Boys surfer rock style music happening, but I want them to be that style covers of ballads from Shakespearean times. So I guess of the Elizabethan era.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would be a really, really fun experiment. I think you can do a lot with that. And I think it gets at that kind of joining two old storytelling forms that are very kind of venerable together.
Yeah.
And it also is scratching an itch for me to do a production that has a really strong aesthetic, but isn't taking itself so seriously, because I feel like that's going to pull against the silliness of it. So that's why I was thinking like a Gidget style thing, because that is so airy and whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what I have.
Yeah.
You can go for it.
Okay. So my biggest issue, I think, here is putting these quasi-contemporary songs in a version of the play that alters the setting while still keeping the text pretty much as it is a hat on a hat on a hat sort of thing, where it is just too many gimmicks and the entire thing starts to crumble under the weight of all these different ideas. I think you have two options here. One would be to abandon almost all the original text of the play and use era-appropriate language of the 30s and 40s. The story can kind of be the same, but then you don't feel like burdened by the structure or the text of the play, and it allows you to make choices like, you know, you can show the other two guys falling in love with the women a little bit. They can have something sort of to do here. Nathaniel and Holofernia romance could actually blossom in some way if you wanted it to blossom in some way, because, you know, you don't really get an opportunity in the movie because one of these characters is a man and presumably not interested in another man in the play. Don't know, never read it. So I think some of the overall slightness of the whole endeavor could be strengthened by you're not really feeling that the only text you can use is the play's text. It frees you up a lot. Even if you wanted to keep some of the language for some of the moments, kind of like how My Own Private Idaho occasionally has characters lapse into Shakespearean yeah. language. You could still do it for scenes where characters are feeling so much that they have to sort of use the words of Shakespeare to communicate the fact that these are like big, deep, important feelings, emotions that go back hundreds of years, mm-hmm. and this is what I have to draw upon to illustrate it to you. That being said, I don't think Kenneth Branagh would ever do that. He seems fine with trimming Shakespeare's text, but I don't think he would want to ever abandon Shakespeare's text. It seems like he just loves the work of Shakespeare too much to sort of replace it entirely. Mm-hmm. Option two, kind of what you had said there actually, Chris, would be to write original songs.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I was curious, one of the things I was looking at when I was looking up my many interviews with Kenneth Branagh is, did he try to write original songs? At any point, did anyone say to him, why don't you write songs for yeah. this? And he says, and I have this condensed for brevity, we did try. We began by thinking in original songs, and the real mistake we made was to actually write them. They were terrible. The problem is the lyrics. It's very hard to, while retaining the original Shakespeare, come up with original lyrics that don't look silly next to them. We did look at some of the less well-known songs of these composers, and that also didn't work. So theoretically, at some point, he was also looking at Cole Porter songs that you don't know. And to that, I would say, I don't know, man, maybe you need a better songwriter. Like, I don't know who the...
Again, that's a money thing, right?
Well, that's the problem. Like, I don't know. He says we. I don't know who we is.
I don't know who is either, but that's more people you got to pay if you're going to have to.
But he already has Patrick Doyle, who has written music for Shakespeare songs before, because if you remember the end of Much Ado, yeah. they do that poem set to music, which was Patrick Doyle's music.
I'm just saying maybe it's a factor of money.
If it was, he didn't specify that. Okay. You think that would be something he would say. So, like, look, I get that this is a challenge. I don't think it's an insurmountable obstacle. Like, maybe you just needed better collaborators or something. You have a slight scale for these songs where you can eschew the text entirely or just sort of dip back in as you need be, or, you know, just stick with strict Shakespearean language and then write melodies to go with it or something like that. Do you know, like, whatever you are feeling at the moment, I think that there are options that Kenneth Branagh had that he just sort of disregarded for this for whatever reason. Money, time, lack of vision, I don't know what it is. I also do think, Lee, this was something you said that I want to crib. Each one of the guys needs a gimmick. One of them needs to be the music guy, one of them is the dancing guy, one of them is like a singing guy.
Comment, you mean?
Yeah, where it's just sort of each guy has a thing that they do, so whenever you see them, at least they have like that personality trait to hang a hat on. And I also kind of like the idea of Don Armando was more of a Latin Lothario type than sort of a ridiculous buffoon, just because I think that's such a stock character of 1940s cinema.
That's what I was saying. I don't know if from the play he's meant to sort of be buffoonish.
Well, I think he's always supposed to be a silly character.
He's silly, but I think like he might still be able to be like, I don't know, gallant or endearing in a weird way.
Right. I mean, it's not so much the portrayal. It's just the idea that I think Timothy Spall is sort of a goofy looking Armando. Where if you had sort of more like a Cesar Romero type, handsome older gentleman, I think like you can still have him be silly, but there's sort of this aspect that falls in line with a lot of Hollywood movies of the 30s and 40s as well.
The Latin lover.
Well, like he could be earnest. He doesn't come off as very earnest. He comes off as just like a caricature of a person.
Right, yeah. And that's funny. I admit that's funny, but it's not really a character, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I got.
I mean, I don't know. I kind of like a lot of this movie. I agree that it's not perfect. I guess if I'll do like a fix where I don't change much, because it's kind of tough where I'm like fixing this particular version of Love's Labor's Lost,
right.
Which is I'm doing my own Love's Labor's Lost. And then if I'm doing that, how much of what Kip Ronick is doing here am I taking? Am I taking the musical bit? Am I not taking the musical bit? So I'm just going to like say what I would do to Ronick's current version to maybe make it better.
I think that's
just
fair.
Go on a wild tangent, short one though, of like what else you could do with Love's Labor's Lost. What I would do to make this better is I would just set it before World War II. Just like it's 1933 or 4. It's not a factor right now. There's some other silly reason why they have to spend a year apart. You were saying that you had, I don't think it really came up in this particular recording, but that the way the characters are balanced right now feels off to you, and the fact that there's two guys that don't do much of anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important that there is more than the first two guys, because you need other bodies to object or have opinions or to fail. And in those scenes where they're all walking in one by one, and it's like, oh, everyone fucked up. Not just me fell in love. This guy fell in love, and that's funny. I don't know if it's like three because it's a funny comedy number, or you keep it to four, but you either divide lines up more equitably, although I do think that you focus more equally on the King and Barone. Ferdinand and Barone are like the more important figures here, and the other two are just there to sort of establish that, like, yes, this is happening on a wider scale. I liked a lot of the choices. Like, I like the choice to have Boyer as the sort of main main princess's servant advocate person. I like Custard as a vaudeville guy. Yeah. The musical numbers, I think we've all talked about, there's a lot of problems. Just fix those. Fix those problems. I'm not the one who's going to tell you how. I'm not a choreographer. I don't know how to pick better songs, but the songs that I liked the best were cut the shortest. Like, I liked the I Won't Dance bit, mm-hmm. and I liked the Charleston bit, and those are the two shortest ones, and I wish they were both longer.
Yeah.
There's some musical numbers that I'm like, I know that you kind of like it, but there's one, some of the goofy stuff that Don Imada does I could do without. I know that, like, filmically, maybe it's nice to see what he does in that song, but I'm like, I don't really care about Don Armando that much, so I don't know if I need this as a whole number, especially because, like, the people that get big numbers are, like, not even the main characters. Like,
it is weird that we spend so much time with, yeah. like, Nathan Lane and Don Armando singing songs.
And then fucking School Norms.
Right, yeah.
The school people right. have, like, a whole song, and it's like the king doesn't
like,
get a song.
Yeah, like I don't Corona care. You're right, like, who cares what these two old people think right yeah. now?
So that's kind of whack. You need to rearrange it and give the main characters more big songs. I think you've got a fairly solid
plot
for, like, a more of a sort of screwball comedy of the 30s.
Yeah.
Rather than, like, it's World War II is happening. When it comes to, like, Love's Labor's Lost, it's such a silly play. I think it's so hard to, like, no one's for real in it. Like, no one's that serious. No one learns anything, really. But I like the idea of it having this, like, time break at the end where it's like, now we gotta wait a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the fact that it is, like, is that sort of that Seven Brides for Seven Brothers vibe of, like, there's just a camp of boys and a camp of girls. We gotta get together. And I feel like there's a lot you could do with that. And just sort of while you were talking about your idea and while I was thinking really about different eras, like, what about, like, a band camp or, like, a summer camp mm-hmm. or, like, between high schools? Like, any type of setting like that would yeah. be, like, and that's, then all of this, like, ridiculous behavior or something.
I mean, this is truly one of those plays that would make more sense if the main characters were teenagers.
Yeah.
Because, like, teenagers have these, like, big dumb ideas. And, like, yeah. I can honestly see a teenager being like, guys, like, if we want to get anywhere, we got to fucking focus on shit and, like, forget yeah. girls for a while.
We're going to Acer grades for the next year.
Right, yeah, exactly. If we want to get into a good college and do well the SATs, we got to study.
Yeah.
And then, like, four attractive women show up and you're like, whoa.
Yeah. So I feel like a high school adaptation would actually be really apt for this.
I agree.
Play. I don't know what you could do with that. There's a lot. If you wanted to make it a musical, why not invoke your favorite, whoever's making it, go back to your high school times and pick the genre of the time, right? I mean, for me, it would certainly be emo and pop punk. Been there before. And I won't go down that well again on this podcast. but yeah, there's just, I think it's hard, like, I think there is some stuff you could do with it, but it's hard to have it do anything remotely serious because it is just, like, do you know what else it would really make sense as? It's like one of those 80s horn dog movies.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Uh-huh. 100%.
Absolutely. Where the cats are, like, punching holes in the
ground. Right, right, to see them shower and all
like,
that shit.
Like,
yeah.
Porkies is what
yeah, 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 yeah.
Like, it's that level of, like, sophistication
right,
like,
yeah,
in
yeah.
the plot. So it's kind of hard to say what else you would do with it other than
I mean,
a broad big comedy.
Talk about a wonderfully sacrilegious idea.
Yeah, Shakespeare
by Porky. What if Shakespeare
by Porky? Yeah.
I mean, I think it worked.
I mean,
I
it
do
was
too.
Absolutely
I'm not arguing it.
Like, yeah.
Oh, I just mean, like, you know, people would be like, how dare you?
But it's not, like, even people that actually read and study Shakespeare will tell you that, like, it was.
He made
yeah.
entertainment for
right, this is, like, low, yeah, this is, like, low comic horniness, yeah.
yeah. So, yeah, I think just don't take it too seriously, whatever you do with this play.
Yeah.
Would you recommend this movie?
Yeah.
It's short.
I would.
It's weird. You're never going to see anything like it, I think.
That is certainly true. It is short. I appreciate its brevity. There's a lot of performances I do like in this, and some of the numbers I enjoy a lot. But I really, truly do think something about this just feels unbalanced. And the overall burden of the impending World War II stuff really just fucking sinks so much of this movie for me. I'm honest to God, straight down the middle. I don't know. I do think it's probably worth watching once, because like Lee said, there is nothing like this. This is clearly Kenneth Branagh's vision,
like,
and a vision that you will never see from someone
there's
else.
There's like an old angry video game nerd quote. I can't remember. It's like some board game that comes with a VHS tape on how to play it.
Oh my God.
And
yeah.
it's like a really weird thing where it's so bizarre and so crazy. And the way he describes it is like, nothing has ever looked like this before or will look like this ever again. And that's kind of
that's
why
true.
I love this movie. Like,
yeah.
you should see it for that reason alone.
No, that's certainly is true. I'm still kind of divided straight down the middle, but I think that's a very good point.
Yeah.
Guys, it's been an episode.
It's been an episode.
Come
a great time.
Back at us in 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
We'll have another topic. We'll talk about what we're doing for our next episode.
Yep.
Fall approacheth.
Fall approacheth. I think
fall
we're, approacheth. Yeah, we're approaching our Halloween spooktacular, I believe,
yeah.
at that point. So.
The spooky era time.
Yeah. Yes, the spookiest time
get
of year.
Get your skeletons ready.
Yep.
Yeah. See you in 2 weeks.
Yep.
Bye.
I get no key in a blind. some girl in the sky. It's my idea of nothing to do. Yet I get a kick. I'm sure it's a kick. I get a kick out of you.